So we've been studying through this book of Genesis now for many months, and we've arrived today at this chapter, chapter 13. In the past couple of chapters, we've been introduced to this man by the name of Abram. Of course, we will come to know him later as Abraham, and his wife, who's now called by Sarai, will be named Sarah, be given a new name later on. So when we refer to Abram and Sarai, you know who we're talking about. He's this man who will come to be known as this great man of faith. He has faith in the one true God. Make no mistake about it. We've learned even last week that Abram is just a man. And when you look at some of the foolish decisions that even this great man of faith makes, I guess it can serve two purposes. One, and you can think, oh, what is this guy thinking? He's so foolish. Like, this is so obvious. Come on, let's never be that silly. On the other hand, you might think, well, I can kind of relate. But we are given glimpses into his life, which demonstrates that he didn't always place his faith where he should, like in chapter 12. We see that. And really a running theme, though, throughout the book of Genesis is this, and you're going to see it throughout Abram's life, in the good and in the bad, in the mountaintops and the valleys, and that's this: trust the Lord in all circumstances of life. Trust the Lord in all circumstances in life. And that's going to be the theme of our chapter today as well. So let's recap just a little bit about this man Abram, which is going to set the stage for our chapter today. So Abram's father, do you remember the name of his father? Terah. His name was Terah, and he had been called to leave the land of the Chaldeans, which was located in Ur, and Abraham and his wife and his father and his brother's son, Lot, his brother who had died, his son Lot, they left that place where the Chaldeans were, that place called Ur, and they went to a land called Haran. It was northwest of where they were located. And so they get to Haran, and this is where God met with Abram and his wife. And he said, follow me, and I'm going to take you to a land that I will show you. That's it. Kind of vague, right? And yet Abram was a man of faith, at least in this moment, and he followed. Didn't have all the details of the trip, didn't even have a map where he was going, had no idea. He just knew, follow God. And so he set out on a journey. And we trust that it was the Lord who led him where he was to go. And of course, we know that by his journey, he ended up going southwest from that location all the way to what would be modern day Jerusalem, near Jerusalem. So they leave Haran with his nephew in tow, Lot. They head to the land of Canaan. That's southwest of Haran. And he's already demonstrating a willingness to follow the Lord, as I said. And that just takes incredible faith to leap out, to leave all that you know, to not have an acre to your name, to not have all that much possession probably at this point in his life. That all comes after Egypt, I think, mostly. To have very little in life and to just hit the road and say, God told me to go, and he says he's going to promise me this great land, not because of who I am, because who he is and what he wants to do. So I'm just going to go. And things are dangerous at these times to travel. It's not like it is nowadays. But he goes, so he's displaying great faith. Along the way, he comes to this place called Shechem. And the Lord appears to him and says, to your offspring I will give this land, but not yet. Right? So Abram goes on to a place that is in between two cities, in between Ai and Bethel. And there he made an altar to the Lord. And he called upon the Lord, and the Lord met with him once more. A blessing is given. Essentially that I will bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. I will make you a great nation. But something happens immediately after that. Remember what it was? It was a famine that hit the land. And apparently it was a severe famine. And rather than Abram keeping in the attitude of trusting in the Lord and having great faith in the Lord, he got me to this land. He says, this is the land I'm going to give you and your descendants. Rather than him just camping out there and say, okay, Lord, you're just going to take care of me. Then you got me this far, and this is what you said. You give me this. I have faith. He kind of panicked, and he goes south, and he goes to Egypt. He says, well, I know they don't worship our God, but they're pretty well off, so I'm going to go to them for help. So he goes down south to Egypt. So Abram and his wife, who had been barren up until this point, They leave God's promised land when difficulty hits, and at that moment, they stop trusting in God's provision. They go to Egypt. And you know what happens when they get to Egypt, right? Walks in, and what does he tell his wife? He says, I want you to pretend that you're actually my sister. Because if you're my wife, I don't have faith in the Pharaoh and these Egyptians. I think they're going to kill me and take you for themselves. So in order to spare my life, you tell a lie, and I'll be the one to parrot that lie as well. And we'll both just say that you're my sister, and we'll see what happens to you, but at least they're going to spare my life, basically, is what goes down. And so he sacrifices his wife and her virtue on the altar of his own survival. What a wretched decision, right? So much for this man of faith. How many men in here would still be married if you did that to your wife? None of us, right? Well, God is not pleased, because what happens? Pharaoh takes Sarai into his harem. It's implied in every translation I saw, except for, what was that, the New King James, that maybe hinted that she didn't consummate the relationship with Pharaoh, but every other translation acted like she did. When Pharaoh starts getting these plagues on him from God, who is ticked off at what Abram has done and what Pharaoh has done, because remember the blessing, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And although Abram's going to get some real physical blessings out of this whole encounter, man, it's like I'm going to curse those, because Pharaoh is not being a blessing to you by taking your wife for himself. I'm going to curse him in this moment. So it brings these plagues upon the house of Pharaoh. This is the first account. We don't know the details of the plagues, but they come. And so Pharaoh gets, whatever happens, he gets full effect of it. And he comes to Abram and he says, how dare you? You should have told me this was your wife. Now you look at the mess you've got me in. Please leave and take all this stuff with you, right? He still sends him out with a blessing. And I think it's because he understood those who bless him, this man, are blessed. Those who curse him are cursed. I've already felt the cursing part. I'm going to send him with a huge amount of riches and blessings, because I don't want any more of this plagues upon my household. And so Abram leaves kind of like a dog with his tail tucked between his legs, right? He's been scolded by the Pharaoh himself, but he has all these blessings, but he can't really boast about that because he essentially traded his wife's virtue for the blessings. But he got his wife back. Now he's very wealthy. He heads out of Egypt and goes back north. Something was learned along that path back from Egypt to the north. Something took place, and we don't read about it, but we can assume that God was at work in the heart of Abram. Because what did Abram do? He goes right back to the altar he had erected in between Ai and Bethel, and he worships. He offers sacrifice, and he worships. I think that was a pivotal moment in this man's life. He could have said, I've got all this material blessing. I'm just going to do my own thing. And I've already messed everything up. So I'm just going to live my life the way I want to live it now. Like, what's the point? God's never going to use me again anyways. But he doesn't do that. And aren't you thankful that whenever you mess up, that God has grace that still abounds in your life so that you shouldn't have that attitude either? To say, I've messed up too much, God, I might as well just go ahead and throw it all away and do whatever I want now, I guess. No. That's a pivotal moment in his life. And so he continues to worship. And so we see our story today. We pick up in chapter 13. Abram now has left Egypt, right? So we come really to the first truth that can be applied to us as we read this, as well as anybody else who's ever read this before. And that's this. Great riches and wealth don't mean that all your problems go away. We're about to see that. Look at verse 1. So Abram went from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him into Negeb, just like the southern part of modern-day Israel. Verse 2. Now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. He journeyed on from Negeb as far as Bethel to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, to the place where he had made an altar at the first. And there Abram had called upon the name of the Lord. So he calls on the name of the Lord again. Okay? But problems are just fixing to get started for Abram. He's got all this stuff. He's accumulated this wealth and these riches. But just having that stuff doesn't fix problems. If anything, sometimes it creates problems. right? If we try to tell these lessons to our kids, it's like it goes in one ear and out the other, because they get dollar signs in their mind, and that's all they want to pursue. And they think, well, if I just have a good paying job, then I'm set. I get everything I want. And then you find yourself parking at the very back of Walmart, at the very end of the parking lot, because you're afraid somebody's going to ding your door on your nice new truck or something, right? And then something, you just can't control it. You create all new types of stresses for yourself just because you're pursuing something that is going to fade. It can't be sustained. I mean, all you got to do is look at Hollywood and all these people and professional athletes. They have all the money in the world. And half of them are committing suicide, seems like, and they're all miserable and depressed and on drugs all the time. What's going on? They keep putting stuff in this hole, thinking that's going to fill the void, and it never does. It's never enough. Great riches and wealth don't mean that all your problems go away. Now, do I want my kids to struggle to make ends meet? No, I don't. Do I want them to be productive citizens? Of course I do. But do I want them to make a big deal about finding a career that pays a whole lot of money? I don't. Why? Because the pursuit of money can be like a drug. It can enslave you and bring all sorts of trouble with it. Don't put your trust in your stuff. You remember the story in the New Testament of the rich young ruler who came to Jesus and he says, "Teacher, tell me what I must do to enter into heaven." And what did Jesus say? He says, gives him a list of some of these commandments, right? Well, have you da 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 da? Gives him a list of the moral things that he's supposed to have done. And Jesus wasn't saying be good to get to heaven. He's trying to reveal to this guy that he has not kept the law, and therefore he's going to need forgiveness, right? That's the point. But this guy in his arrogance says, "Oh, well, I've done all that since my youth. I've kept all the law." Well, that was foolish. Of course he hadn't kept all the law, but he thought he had, puffing out his chest. And so then Jesus says, "Well, there's one other thing you must do, by the way." "Oh, what's that? Tell me and I'll do it." "Well, take all that you have, all your possessions, go sell them and give the proceeds to the poor, and then you come and follow me." And how does the story end? The young man went away sad. Why? Because he had many possessions. What was his trust in? His stuff. He couldn't let go of that. That was his security in life, was his stuff. How could I leave and forsake all of my security and go follow you when I don't have a clue where you're going, and you don't seem to have much as it is? I think I'm going to go with this. So his issue wasn't necessarily morality, although I think it was. He'd convinced himself it wasn't a moral problem. It was idolatry. He was elevating his love for his stuff over Christ, Jesus, right? You're going to see some of that here in our story today, but it's not from Abram. It's from his nephew. But you got to keep this in mind, especially some of you younger people, and I say younger, I mean under 30. Stuff won't satisfy. Don't fall into that trap of seeking after and getting accumulating more and more and more stuff. And you think, "I'll just be happy if I can just get this, if I can just get this." No, you will not. You're going to always deal with the same mess everybody in this planet has to deal with. So what do you have to pursue that's going to help you through that mess? It's what you need, not what you want. And along the way, God's going to give you fun things, I think, and it's going to be some things that you want, but that shouldn't be what you pursue and what you're driven by. Pursue what you need and trust God along the way. Don't put your trust in your stuff. Great wealth can bring great temptation. Temptation to find your security in that stuff, and you begin to view things through the lens of what makes you feel secure rather than what's God asking me to do. Hear me say this, wealth is a false security. It can be here one day and gone the next. Look no further than the stock market. Who should we place our faith and our trust in above all else? And I say who, not what. It's God. So Abram leaves Egypt, and he goes, as we said. Where's he ultimately headed? He's headed to wherever the Lord wants him to go, and that's the key. You're not going to see that with Lot. Lot's going to go where his eyes see as a delight to him. He's going to be very pragmatic in his decision-making, whereas Abram just says, "Hey, what do you want next, Lord? I'm going to try to follow you." Now, he's not perfect in that. You're going to see in chapters to come. He makes some of the same mistakes that he already made in chapter 12. But overall, he's a man of faith. And what's interesting, looking at where he went back and he went back to that altar that he had erected earlier, and he worshiped God there and he called upon the name of the Lord. This should be our pattern as well, right? I mean, we go through something difficult, whether it's a famine or we get humiliated because of some horrible decision we made. Our first knee-jerk reaction should be, we're going to go worship the Lord and go to His people. And I can't tell how many times I've seen families go through difficulty and just not show up to church for months on end. Why? I guess there's a number of reasons they convince themselves why, but ultimately, they're not making the right decision. Your knee-jerk reaction should be, I want to be in the presence of the Lord and His people. I want to worship Him in the midst of my struggle. And I need to be around people who are going to tell me the things that are right and helpful, not the stuff that want to tickle my ears that are going to lead me astray, right? And I've seen that over and over again. You know, one thing about COVID, I think it revealed a lot of things to us about our society. It revealed that government wants complete control, wherever country you live in. They want to exercise their will over the people at all cost, and they'll offer you so-called security in exchange for your freedoms. Another thing it revealed is how much people can be driven by fear over faith. It's like people totally forgot, within the church, people totally forgot God is sovereign. And they begin to think somehow, if I just do this certain thing the government tells me to do, I can prolong my days. Don't you know that God has already numbered your days? You're not in control of that. He's sovereign. But fear is an incredibly powerful thing. In times of difficulty, we should be in the habit of worshiping God, not giving in to our fear. And to his credit, Abram did this. Look at verse 5. It says, and Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. No doubt, some of this might have come from his grandfather through his father as a blessing, but I think most of it was just through Abraham or through Abram in his encounter in Egypt still. I think most of the riches they got came through Egypt. Now, Abram is probably giving this young man more and more responsibility. We don't know his age at this point, but he's probably giving him more and more responsibility, saying, hey, I know that you're your own man. I want to treat you as a son of my own, and I don't have a son. I'm going to treat you like my son. I'm going to give you responsibility over all these things. The story that comes to mind is like the prodigal son. He wants his inheritance right now, and he goes and squanders it, right? They got so much stuff now after their Egyptian journey that they can't even support all these things, right? They don't have enough grass to feed their cattle. They don't have enough water for them to drink, apparently. And there's infighting going on between the herdsmen. Not only that, but apparently between Lot. And how I get to that is because later on he addresses Lot personally and specifically and says, let us not have strife between us. Let us not quarrel. We're kin. We have a bloodline that we share. Like, come on, we're family. Not only do I not want our workers underneath us to struggle, but I don't want us to. I don't want any beef to be between us. Notice the wisdom of Abram when he notices that these issues are cropping up, right? Verse 8 says, then Abram said to Lot, let there be no strife between you and me and your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Abram is a peacemaker. And didn't we see Jesus talk about that in the New Testament? Blessed are the peacemakers, he said on the Sermon on the Mount, for they shall be called the children of God. Man, good on Abram. He's trying to be a peacemaker. And you and I should be peacemakers wherever we go. Now think of who's reading this text for the very first time after it was first written. Who wrote Genesis? Moses, right? Who's reading Genesis as he's writing this down and reading it to the whole of the people? The Israelites, the descendants of Abraham, later on down the road, right? This is significant whenever he talks to Lot about there being no strife between them, because the first readers of this document would have known that the descendants of Lot would go on to constantly be at war with the Israelites. Constantly. Specifically, a couple of groups of people, and they were called the Moabites and the Ammonites. You remember the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and God sitting down all the fire from heaven and destroyed the cities, right? And Lot's fleeing the city. His wife looks back, turned to a pillar of salt. Well, afterwards, he has two sons, okay? And so his sons' names are Moab and Ammon. And they go on to produce the Moabites and the Ammonites. You might remember this story in Numbers chapters 22 through 25. You have Balak, the king of Moab. And what does he do? He tries his best to bribe a prophet of the Lord, Balaam, to curse the people of Israel. What does Balaam say? I can't do that. Those who bless these people will be blessed. Those who curse them will be cursed. I'm not going to try to curse these people. The Ammonites join up with the Moabites at one point to fight against the Israelites, as I said. Now, you thought the Hatfields and the McCoys had family strife, and they have nothing on Abraham's father's descendants. Nothing. You remember the famous woman that came out of the Moabite people, right? Ruth. She was a Moabite. By the way, the great-grandson of Ruth is who? King David. King David. That's pretty amazing, right? So even though there's strife and war and fighting through all these people groups with the God's people, God ends up still bringing peace. Abraham was right when he said, let there be no strife between us. So notice what Abram does next to help stem the tide of strife. And it's really incredible. Verse 9 says, Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, then I will go to the right. If you take the right hand, then I will go to the left. So he sets aside his rights, and he lets his younger nephew have first pick of everything. He didn't have to do that, right? I mean, he was Lot's uncle. He's older, he's wiser, he's wealthier, he has more authority. Yet he seeks to bless Lot even in the midst of their struggle and their disagreement. When was the last time you had an argument with somebody in your family and you just kind of gave in and said, you know what? What would make you happy right now? I want to go out of my way to bless you. How many times we do that? No, we want to win and we want to die on this hill if we have to. And every single battle is worth dying on, dying at, right? That's usually how we treat our own family. And Abram, he's setting the bar pretty high here. Do you seek to bless others in your time of difficulty with them? What would you do in Abram's shoes? If you're wearing his sandals and you have to face this younger guy come to you with his arrogance and he's ticked off and he's stirring up trouble in the camp. Maybe he lost some confidence in you based on your actions in Egypt. I don't know. Maybe he's pulling that up, reminding you about how bad of a decision maker you are. I mean, you couldn't even protect your own wife's virtue. How am I supposed to follow you? What would you do to that guy? Would you put him in his place? Probably, if you're a man in the room, right? You wouldn't hesitate. Put the guy in his place. That's what I'm going to do. Abram doesn't do that. You say, what kind of man is this? Is he a weak man? No. He's a godly man. He's a godly man. And so he seeks peace. He's a peacemaker. So what is Lot's response? This is really crucial. It really is the whole point of Genesis 13. Look at verse 10. And Lot lifted up his eyes, and he saw the Jordan Valley that was well watered everywhere like the garden of the Lord. What's a garden of the Lord? Garden of Eden, right? Well, you have to read this through the lens, I think, of the people who are first reading this, the Israelites. They're not associating the garden of the Lord and the actions that took place there. Probably that's not a good thought, because the last action of the garden of the Lord was the sin and the fall of mankind that got them expelled from the garden. And then also when he talks about comparing this to, he says, like the land of Egypt, they're thinking, the people who are reading this now, they're thinking of just coming out of slavery in Egypt. They're not associating that as a blessing. They're like, oh, this guy is messed up. And it goes on, it says, in the direction of Zoar. So he's looking to leave the promised land. That's the point. It says, this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east. Thus they separated from each other. And then it talks about Abram settling in the land of Canaan. But Lot goes as far as Sodom, and then it says the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. And we know to the extent of some of their wickedness later on, and their homosexuality later on. Notice that Lot didn't drop to his knees and seek God's advice whenever Abram presented him with the choice that he had to make, right? What would you have done in that situation? I mean, let's say you're, I'm just guessing, let's say you're 20 years old. You're 20 years old. Somebody says, I'm going to give you the first pick. You get to choose half of what I have, and I'm going to let you get the best of everything. Now, you can just look at all that I have, and you pick. You're going to be rubbing your hands together, licking your lips, thinking, man, this is my shot. That's what Lot did. He opened his eyes. He looked around. He gazed around. He said, ooh, I'll take that one and that one and that one. And ooh, that looks nice over there. He never once thought to drop on his knees and ask God for advice. He never once thought to even ask Abram, hey, I'm young and I'm probably going to choose foolishly here. And you know what? I remember what God said. Those who bless you will be blessed. So how about you get the first pick? I want to bless you. Never once crossed his mind. No, I want to get mine. And that's the way of the world, is it not? I'm going to look out for me. Whatever happens, I'm going to climb the ladder of success and step on whoever I got to step on so that I take care of me, because I love me some me. That's the world. That's Lot. The Bible has something to say about looking at life this way. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15 says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. That's harsh, but that's truth. Verse 16 says, for all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride of life is not from the Father, but from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires, but whoever does the will of God abides forever. Don't have such a temporal view. Have an eternal view. Here's the truth. Our decision-making should reflect our relationship with God. If your decision-making reveals a carnality within your own heart, then you need to get right with God. Your relationship with God is struggling, if it even exists. You know who Lot sounds a lot like? Eve. When she fell. Remember what she said? Genesis chapter 3, verse 6. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, she's looking around, right? And that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, what can this do for me? She took of its fruit and ate. So Lot's already forgotten the truth that God gave to Abram, those who bless you, I will bless, those who curse you, I will curse. He's only looking inward, he's thinking of himself only, and he makes his choice. When we make our decisions based on what we want rather than what we need, or what is appealing to our flesh rather than the deeper things of life, we tend to get in trouble. I can't help but think of our young men and women in our congregation. Big decisions that you make from ages of, say, 17 to 30 or so. Man, some of these decisions will affect you the rest of your life. Your career path, your future spouse, if you're going to own the faith that you were raised in for yourself. Those are huge decisions. And then there's a lot of temptation for you to look at what appeals to the flesh, the job with the most money. I'm going to go for the spouse that I think is the most attractive. Now, am I saying that I want you to pursue working at McDonald's the rest of your life? No, of course not. Right? Nothing against McDonald's, but that's not going to pay the bills when you got a family to raise. I'm not saying that's what your aspirations should be. Am I saying that you should go marry somebody ugly? No. Of course not. That's not the point. The point is, look beyond that. Because beauty will fade, even in the most beautiful person. It's not going to stay looking like that forever. They're not. You better hope that you've married somebody that is deeper than just skin deep, their beauty, right? You better look deep within. Is that going to be somebody you want to raise your kids? Is that going to be somebody you can sit and have a cup of coffee with after you've been married for 30 years, and you still have things to say because they're like a book that you've just got past the first couple chapters trying to understand? Do you just pursue the job that is going to pay you six figures, but you're miserable? You hate going to work? No. Do something's going to make you happy, even if you barely get by, but you're paying your bills and you're putting food on the table, right? big decisions that you have to make, younger people. Don't just make your decisions based on what's appealing to the eyes. In other words, seek wisdom. Seek the Lord. Where does it say that Lot settled? And then we're going to end here. It said he settled at the land of Sodom, where the men were known for being exceedingly wicked. Do you think Lot knew that they were exceedingly wicked? I think he did. Didn't factor in, did it? Doesn't mean that Lot was like them. I don't think that. I'm not going to jump to that conclusion because later on he gets spared. But I do think he knew they were wicked. He's probably just thinking, man, what's going to make me money? What, this is like an enterprise, right? What's going to profit me? The chapter ends with God's blessing Abram once more. I'm not going to read through those, but you can look at them, verses 14 through 18. I think a key word there in verse 15 is forever. It says, for the land that you see, I will give you and your offspring forever. That's important because forever means forever. So the land doesn't belong to the Palestinians. It doesn't belong to whoever wants to conquer Israel in any given decade. It belongs to them because God gave it to them. So Abram continues to worship at the end of the chapter. He's erected a whole nother altar for the Lord. The question is this, is will you worship God for all that you have in life, even if it's a little bit, or if it's a lot, knowing that whatever you have is thanks to Him? And will you seek to make wise choices and not just what appeals to the flesh in the here and now? Let's pray.